and gentlemen, welcome to the third quarter wrap-up news trends and stories. We've had quite an explosive news process for the last 3 months. Our wonderful Top Picks editor has weekly compiled all the top picks. We posted hundreds of what we believe are the top stories of each week. Then we synthesize them, collect them, talk about them throughout the quarter, looking for the really important patterns. And it's a very time-consuming and serious process, and it helps me tremendously in kind of seeing the bigger picture. So I value it, particularly when I look at the stories and the trends next to the financial charts and what's happening in the money. We're going to talk about news trends and stories, as we regularly do, in two parts. Part one is going to be the economy and financial markets and geopolitics, and then part two will be science and technology and the big questions. All the stories are linked within the trends on your web presentation, and I would encourage you to go log in at Solari.com, get to the Resource Center. This will also be up at Giza Death Star, so whether you access from Giza Death Star or from Solari.com, it helps to follow along with all the trends and to be able to link through. And of course, we'll have a full transcript of our discussion, which will be up both on the websites as well as in the hard copy, if you're getting the hard copy. And when the hard copy comes up, it will be available at the store. So needless to say, the greatest part, one of the greatest parts of my year, is quarterly chewing through news trends and stories with Dr. Joseph Farrell, who joins us today. Joseph, it's such a pleasure to have you.
Well, hi, Catherine. Thanks for having me back on.
I think one of the reasons I don't feel overwhelmed by this list is I think that's okay. Joseph's big brain will be here to help.
Well, like I told you before we started, I haven't even had a chance really to look at it all that closely, so I'm kind of tap dancing here, folks.
Well, we've talked through most of these already,
yeah.
So
I think
you're really on top of this. And reading your website and listening to your vid chats, I know you're on top of this. So, but before we start, one of the biggest requests I get from subscribers when I see them is they say, when can we have an opportunity to meet Dr. Joseph Farrell? They all want to meet you. So before we begin, I just want to point out again that we're going to be having a dinner on October 15th. We decided that given all the different directions we're coming from, we'd meet at a midpoint in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And we're having a dinner at a great Kilcarney's Irish Pub from 7 to 11, October 15th. That's a Saturday evening. You're going to be there, I'm going to be there, and
yep.
We're going to be talking about your new organ. We're launching a crowdfund. Now, this is my idea. Don't blame this on Joseph. We're going to be launching a crowdfund to get you an organ, a real live, big, hunking, big organ, but it has virtual pipes,
yep.
Which is why it gets called a virtual pipe organ. But I want to make clear that the organ is not virtual. It's quite substantial. Anyway, so we're going to be launching a crowdfund on October 15th. You'll see more. We'll have a webpage for that crowdfund, and you'll see more on it when we launch on October 15th. But if you want to meet Joseph, here's your chance to do it. You can learn more about it up at the website at Solari.com. It's on the homepage with Joseph looking like the guy in Phantom in the Opera right right in front of
that's
the
a good logo.
It's a great logo. Okay, October 15th, Tulsa, 7 to 11, great dinner. So come on out if you want to get the chance to talk with Joseph and me in person. Okay, Joseph, last second quarter, we ended the quarter with Brexit happening the day before the end, big bang, boom. And so you and I had a great deal to talk about. It was a fascinating discussion, so good we put the whole transcript in our hard copy, which is the first time we've done it, but we said everybody's got to see this. So we ended the quarter with Brexit, and now we have an event or a combination of events that I think is very much Brexit-like, and I've referred to them as Cut and Run plus Monica Lewinsky too.
Couldn't be more aptly phrased.
But we're watching more and more signals and symptoms that people are, or we have major players pulling money out, whether legally or illegally. You know, we're watching a giant sucking sound, whether it's the Wells Fargo phony accounts and some of the things I suspect are happening around that, or the $6.5 trillion going missing from DOD. If I had to pick one story for the third quarter, it would be the Department of Defense Inspector General announcing that $6.5 trillion was missing at the end of the year. They made $2 trillion of adjustments during the year. So we're now up to $8.7 trillion in 1 year. You know, the sort of the mind boggles. But if you look at that in combination with a new effort to get a constitutional convention and balanced budget amendment, you know, to me it really looks like we're looking at a cut and run. And you probably were too sensible to be part of this, but I lived in Washington, D.C. when the whole Monica Lewinsky impeachment was going on.
Yes.
And that was really designed to cover up the tearing down of internal financial controls and the pulling out of trillions of dollars from federal accounts. The financial coup d'etat started right at that point.
Yep.
They happened together, you know, it was, you know, what was it, buddy being, you know, whatever. It was like amazingly orchestrated. And it was until that time the most powerful shriek-o-meter, you know, we'd ever seen up until that point. And about a month ago, you know, you started to see this explosion of stuff about Clinton health. You know, Clinton's a hologram, she really died, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, it just got shrieker and shrieker. And I said, I've seen this someplace before. Where have I seen this?
Yep.
And I realized, oh, this is Monica Lewinsky, too.
Yes.
And
yes.
I've always said that the campaign was a distraction against the real stuff.
Yes.
But I've been struggling to figure out what the pattern is. You know, what is it that they're distracting against? And I think it's the cut and run.
I happen to agree with you. And, you know, you put the two stories, global central banks are all in, and then Theresa May tells the UN that the UK will not turn inward after the Brexit vote. Well, there's another story that just happened a couple of days ago, and I'm sure that you're aware of it too, and that is that the German government, and this is what my friends in Germany are telling me, they've been sending me all sorts of articles in German, that the German government is not going to bail in Deutsche Bank. So its stock is continuing to tumble. And that's huge. And this follows the German government telling the population, you know, stock up and brace yourself. Something big is coming. And this might be it. And at the same time, I just today got an email from one of my friends in Germany that sent me an email about the latest advertising campaign of Commerzbank, the other large German bank. And its logo is to the effect, Deutsche Bank, well, we're the real German bank, and we're here on your side.
Right.
So in other words, they're preparing people for the potential collapse of that bank. So yeah, I think the whole, I'm with you here. You know, I tried to follow this Clinton health campaign business, and I'm in full agreement with you. I think it's a huge distraction from what's really going on, and that's the financial thing. It was interesting to me, even in the debate last night, Trump wouldn't go to the health issues all that much. He kept hammering away at the financial thing. So, yeah, I think something big is in the works, and I'm in agreement with you. They're pulling money out. You know what they may be doing is having to accelerate their plans to roll it over, as you say, into Global 3.0. That's the way it feels to me.
Well, I started to use the expression cut and run when Lockheed spun their IT division out before the $6.5 trillion missing was announced. So they announced that they were going to spin it in January. They spun it out in July. The announcement from DOD got made in August.
Yep.
And if you look at the date of the announcement of the spin-out, it was the first date after, you know, the calendar involving, you know, the 2015 year. So
Right.
That was the soonest they would be able to do it, you know, if they wanted to stay in control through the federal fiscal 2015 and, you know, but announce after their calendar year was over. So, you know, that just shrieks cut and run. But there's something you brought up, the Germans, and I think this is very interesting. We have suggestions that some of the American banks may be helping ease Deutsche Bank's pain on the derivative side. That's a big question mark. At the same time that we have the Department of Justice putting a huge squeeze on the Germans, they're claiming a $14 billion fine on Deutsche Bank, and their DOJ is going hard after Volkswagen, including indicting one executive on a criminal charges, when in fact we know, you know, GM killed 125 people with the ignition switch, you know, and hardly Bo Peep about that. So something, you know, they're squeezing the Germans on Deutsche Bank and Volkswagen at the same time that Bayer is turning around and buying Monsanto at a 44% premium. If you're going to institute a budget balance amendment, I don't need to tell you what's going to happen to farm subsidies. And given what has happened with commodity prices, the farmers can't afford the seeds anyway. So, and that's now before you mess with farm subsidies. So, you know, if you look at who the insiders are on Monsanto, it's pretty easy to see that somebody wants to get taken out before the election.
Yep. I agree, and I agree with that analysis about Bayer and Monsanto, too. They really are putting the squeeze on the Germans, and, you know, we've discussed this as well many times and often off the record that this is somehow also looking to be a real kind of behind-the-scenes war on Germany. There's so many clues that this might be the case. You know, we had the recent announcement that the Germans are tripling the size of their military. Well, you know, when Germany triples the size of the military, I tend to stand up and take notice. You know, this is a bit of data.
Well, that says they don't. Well, two things. It says they don't anticipate the U.S. honoring their agreements, number one, or pulling back. They just expect a pullback or a collapse.
Exactly.
I think also if they want the euro to survive, they're figuring they need Northern Europe to have a centralized military to make sure that it does survive.
Yeah, and it's interesting too. I just did a News and Views last week about the United States Army participating in wargaming contests in Germany with Denmark, Holland, Poland, Estonia, and a couple of Central European nations, I think the Czech Republic and so on. But the result of the wargaming exercises weren't, as far as the Americans go, weren't too positive. We didn't even place. We were beaten out by Denmark and Poland. The Germans actually won the war game contest, but you know this doesn't bode well either. So there's something going on behind the scenes. But the other thing that I think you're spot on about is this business about Lockheed cutting and running and pulling, you know, spinning off their IT tech division. To me, this is a huge story because what it's suggesting is that our hypothesis of a breakaway civilization, or rather Richard Dolan's, is in fact true, and they really are breaking away. They're severing all of their dubious connections before the storm hits. So there's a lot going on here.
People always say to me, you can't get the money back, and I say, yes, you can, because you can assert common law right of offset. And in fact, the Department of Justice, I was involved in litigation where the Department of Justice asserted common law right of offset to grab back technically an opportunity cost, not even a cash loss. So the precedents legally exist to get, you know, if not all the money back, a significant amount, because the contractors are liable.
Yep.
Think about it. If you're Lockheed and you're the largest seller of weapons and weapon systems to the Department of Defense, it's very convenient to also run the payment and accounting systems.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. It's quite convenient.
Well, here's what's amazing. If you look, you know, ALEC is the association of the state legislatures that's been used to, if you watch the wonderful documentary called Hot Coffee, it talks about how ALEC was used to get tort reform throughout the country. So if you want to get something through the 50 states, it's where, you know, people like Bill Gates go to grease the, you know, the process. Anyway, but the Koch brothers and the conservative groups have been financing a push for a balanced budget amendment and a constitutional convention. They have 28 states. They only need 6 more.
Yeah.
And that has been going on steadily throughout the year while everybody's been watching, you know, the mm-hmm. Howdy Doody show and Monica Lewinsky, too.
Yeah.
And this is pretty frightening because if you open up the Constitution, it depends on how you do it. If you do a budget balanced amendment, it's one process. If you do that plus a constitutional convention and open up the constitutional convention, it's another thing. Whatever, I mean, here's what's interesting, Joseph. We have, under the Constitution, you cannot spend money unless it's been envisioned in an appropriation process. Now,
right.
If the Department of Defense had 2.2 plus 6.5 trillion of undocumentable adjustments last year, that's not legal under the Constitution.
Right, right.
You know, just like all the other missing money since 1998, fiscal 1998 is not legal under the Constitution. So since we're existing, you know, we're existing way outside of the Constitution as it is, why do you need to change the Constitution if you don't have to obey it?
Well, precisely. I can't warn people enough about the dangers of a constitutional convention. Granted, the current system isn't perfect, but my problem with this has always been, do we want to take the chance of having a convention? Let's remember, the Philadelphia Convention in 1787 was basically a bunch of oligarchs getting together, and they were tasked, really, with revising the Articles of Confederation, not coming up with a whole new constitution, which is what they did. So in other words, you open up a constitution convention and the possibility arises that they could scuttle the whole thing altogether and give us something
right.
that we don't want. Do we trust this political class in this country, the Koch brothers, the Bushes, the Clintons, the Soroses, the Rockefellers, and so on? Do we trust that political class to come up with a constitution that's going to be beneficial for the people? Well, I know what my answer is, you know, and it's a
well,
big whopping
here's,
no.
Well, let me bring up two things. NBC recently ran a spot on why our children will soon be microchipped
mm-hmm.
while we keep reading stories about cryptocurrencies and the central banks working on
yep.
their own form of Bitcoin.
Yep.
So we have digital fiat currency combined with chipping people.
Yep.
Does that sound like anything you know?
Well, yeah, it sounds like the beast system in the Book of Revelation, absolutely.
Right.
You know, and the problem there, as far as I see it, is even if they were to attempt to put into place such a system, what they're going to do is they're going to create vast underground economies.
Right.
I think you'll see the rise of local and regional currencies almost overnight as a result of that, because, you know, I for one will not go into a system like that, because, you know, religious theological doctrines aside, the problem is you're surrendering your personal sovereignty, you're surrendering your personal freedom. When you do that, economies break down ultimately, and in a system
right.
like that, you know, do we trust these people? Well, you know, most of us would say no. Their record is pretty clear. And the other problem I have with this whole constitutional convention idea is, it's, you know, you can sit around and say that you're going to pass all these balanced budget amendments that you want. But the problem is you're not going to have a balanced budget as long as you're in the central banking welfare warfare model. And this is the other problem. You know, the only time in American history that I'm aware of that the federal government budget was balanced was under Andrew Jackson. And what did he do? Well, he did not
he
renew
got shot.
The charter of the yeah, he got shot, but he didn't renew this charter of the central bank. And this was the only time in history that we've had a balanced federal budget. And what did the banks do as a result of this? Well, they started printing private banknotes. In other words, they themselves went to the option of local and regional currencies. And
right.
they created a currency crisis in the country. So, you know, I'm extremely skeptical when I hear these calls for a constitutional convention. We don't need to do that. And I suspect, even then, Catherine, that if they were to try that and you know, pull another Philadelphia Convention and give us a whole new constitution, I suspect that there would be regions of the country that simply wouldn't accept it. That would be the beginning of a real crack up. So I think the way to go is what we've discussed. We need to have special district attorneys in the states created to look at each and every federal mandate that comes down and just tie the whole thing up in litigation and do it that way. You know, use the current system and use it for the benefit of the people and the local state governments rather than blow the whole thing up and trust this political class to come in and save the day. I just don't trust them with that.
Let's do the numbers, because to me a good conservative would not say we need a constitutional convention or a balanced budget amendment. They would say there's $21.2 trillion missing from the federal government. Where is it and how do we get it back? Because we heard on the debates last night, we have $20 trillion of debt. Well, wait a minute. You know, $4 trillion missing between 98 and 2002, $8.5 trillion missing on foreign, you know, through Iraq and Iran and Middle Eastern war, $6.5 trillion at the end of the year last year, DOD, and then $2 trillion documentable adjustments during the year. That's $21.2 trillion of documentable adjustments. Plus we had $27 trillion on bailouts. So that's $48.2 trillion. It's kind of like, well, wait a minute. You know, you take $48.2 trillion and then you say you want to budget the, you know, balance the budget. You can't balance the budget without getting that money back. That's how you balance the budget. So if, let's say you and I had a pot. Let's say we had a joint account, bank account together, and we had $1,000 in it. If you took the $1,000 out without my agreement, and then you said, well, we need to balance the books. We can't spend any money because, you know, there's nothing in the account. That's, to me, that's what a balanced budget amendment is. It's basically saying, okay, we stole all the money, so now, you know, now we can't afford to spend money on the things you've been promised. We have to be fiscally responsible, and we can't spend money on you. Does that make any sense?
Yeah,
I'm sorry, guys. Everything went down. My computer, my phone, everything. I had to reboot.
So we're right about cut and run.
After it went down, I heard this boom off in the distance like a transformer had exploded, which I don't think, you know, happened because the electric is still on, but... the boys at Fort Meade aren't too happy with us. But anyway,
it's always good.
Well,
to
you
have
know what happened.
Feedback.
You know what happened to Michael Savage on Monday. He's a talk show host, and he started talking about Hillary's health. Well, they pulled his station. They pulled his live commentary and ran a rerun on his New York affiliate, and then he kept going, and then they yanked all of his other stations in the country.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I mean they're getting blatant. They're getting blatant.
Okay, well.
Anyway, to pick up where we were, you were going over the numbers.
Okay, so let's start again and look at the numbers. If you look at if you listen to the debates last night, I think Trump said we have $20 trillion of debt. Well, if we look at the undocumentable adjustments between fiscal 1998 and today, just what we've counted and is publicly documented is $21.2 trillion. You add the $27 billion of bailouts, that's $48 trillion, you know, that's been handed out. So if we have a pot, we take out $40 trillion and we say, you know something? We have no money left, just debt. We need a balanced budget amendment so that we can abrogate all the contracts that we promised to you guys. My attitude is no. We don't need to keep paying money into a system that just stole $48 trillion or, you know, whatever. At this point, it's really up to $52 trillion now. But we don't need to put, you know, keep paying taxes into something that stole $50 trillion, let alone that's going to abrogate our, you know, its obligations to us. So my attitude is I don't need a balanced budget amendment. I need to know where that $52 trillion went and get it back. And I can get it back because I can get back the equity ownership. So, you know, I don't need to be, I don't have to get cash. I can get back $50 trillion, you know, dollars worth of assets. So I want, a good conservative wants to know where the money is and get it back.
Yes, exactly. And I'll tell you something. This was the subtext, I think, here that was going on in the Clinton-Trump debate on Monday night.
Yeah.
This was the subtext, because you'll notice that what Trump kept harping on was running the numbers. And he even said at one point, I'm a numbers guy, if I remember correctly.
Well, but so he said, do you remember when he, yeah, when he said, look, we spent, you said $6 trillion on Iraq. We could have fixed the country up twice for that amount of money. And what do we have to show for that $6 trillion? Nothing. You go to Europe and Dubai, they're first world countries. We look like a third world country. You know, when we could have fixed ourselves up with that $6 trillion, what do we have to show for all your waste of money? And to me, that was a politically safe, correct way of saying the same thing I'm saying, which is you just stole $50 trillion. We have nothing to show for it. The country looks like a third world country in different places. We certainly don't compare to Europe or parts of the Middle East, and certainly not the parts of Asia. You know, it's time we held you accountable for that. And I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with him here too. But I, you know, I do think the importance here of what we're saying is that this was the real subtext between the two candidates in that debate. I think Trump knows something, and I think they know that he knows it. And this, to me, has been kind of the bellwether of his whole campaign, is that he's turned it into a referendum. You know, I've said over and over, I don't view this election as simply an election. It's a referendum on concepts, and the concepts are, do we want more of Mr. Globaloney's globalism, or do we want to take control of our economic future and reassert our sovereignty over it? And you know, it's really a referendum about that.
See, I think it's a referendum about, you know, centralization, which has a negative return on investment, versus a system that has a positive return on investment. I think Trump ultimately is an equity guy. And he's saying, look, what we're doing, because I don't think Trump or anybody's against globalization, as long as it's got a positive return on investment. But what we're doing is centralizing in a way that has a negative return on investment. And what everybody knows is negative returns on investment end in depopulation or death for most people.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. That's precisely it. And that's, you know, that's always been part of Mr. Globaloney's agenda. Is centralization and depopulation. Well, you know, as I've pointed out, this whole depopulation meme has been around with the central banking, you know, wealthy oligarchy crowd since the Republic of Venice. So, you know, it wasn't invented by Malthus. It wasn't invented by Rockefeller. it's been around for quite a long time. And, of course, the estimates are always wrong, because the bottom line is they're estimating in terms of a closed system of economics and finance, when the reality is technologies change, and as technologies change, the financial system has to change with it. So they're operating with a very, very old paradigm, and this is the problem. It's coming unglued, and they don't know what to do.
Well, the thing that most concerns me when I put together all the stories for Cut and Run, the thing that most concerns me is health freedom. Because if you look at all the, I used your expression, I think I got it from you, bizarro things that are going on, particularly this sort of what I would describe as the Zika op, it's very hard to come up with an explanation other than they need a way of significantly lowering life expectancy to deal with the exploding retirement situation, because what's going to happen after the election is, whether it's the state and local or the private pension funds or Social Security or all these things, and I suspect this is part of why they want the balanced budget amendment, you know, they're going to have to face the fact that they've just stolen the $50 trillion that was necessary to keep the commitments under the retirement systems.
Yep.
And, you know, it's been... it's been Puerto Rico or it's been Detroit. It's been the outliers who have sort of blown up first, but now we're talking about moving in on the, you know, things that are considered to be financially dependable.
Right. And, you know, the other part of your your hypothesis here, that if you're conservative, you don't want necessarily want a balanced budget amendment. You want to know where the money is gone.
Right.
And I would say that in order for that to be effective, you have to punish the criminals. You have to punish the criminals.
Right.
There's no more too big to fail, too big to jail. There has to be people going to prison, and we know who the names are that are at the likely top of the list. These people have to be put into prison, because you can't have a functioning economy without rule of law. You've pointed this out many times, and that rule of law needs to be observed. And this means that there's no more privileged class, effectively. You can't run an economy that way, particularly a global one. This is the lesson that Mr. Global has yet to learn, and I think they're in danger of learning the lesson real soon, and they know it. This is why they're panicked.
Right, which brings us back to one of the reasons they're panicked is that the unipolar vision has failed.
Yep.
And we saw in the third quarter Brzezinski basically write an article declaring that that was the case and we better get on with a multipolar world. And
yep.
I almost fell out of my chair, Joseph.
Yep, I did too. This is a 180-degree reversal of what he's been saying. And, you know, you notice that he said it without any apologies for having messed everything up in the first place. The other interesting thing about this is that the Russians have come out recently. I saw an article on RT that said that, you know, there's no privileged class for big bankers. These bankers have to be prosecuted. So in other words, Russia is in on the game. So there's going to be some sort, I think, of international push to make these bankers accountable for what they've done. So, you know, look for things happening in the International Court at The Hague and so on and so forth. Now, the United States is not a party to that treaty, but that, you know, that says a lot right there. But there's going to be some action, I think, from countries like Venezuela that have been basically raped. I think you're going to see Brazil get in on that with the over, you know, basically the coup d'etat against President Rousseff down there. I think you're going to see a whole host of international action now. Just not necessarily that it's going to be effective, but you're going to see these countries pointing out the flaws in the Western system, and they're going to be pointing at precisely these types of things.
Well, if you look, there's an article this morning in the Wall Street Journal about the falling revenues of Goldman Sachs in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that probably reflects not just a global slowdown, but the fact that you're seeing a real pushback against the Americans in the marketplace.
Yeah, absolutely.
In other words,
yeah. So it's what one of the candidates said during the debates early on, one of the Republican candidates, our friends no longer respect us and our enemies no longer fear us. And
right.
I suspect that's why Goldman's revenues are down. Well, let's talk about the currency.
The other thing is they just don't want to do business with us anymore. And,
right.
And again, you can't blame them.
You know, I think part of this cut and run is people are looking at the switch, you know, the failure of the unipolar vision, the switch to the multipolar world and thinking, okay, well, I'm, you know, I'm nervous about this, so I'm going to cut and run. One of the things we know is coming up at the beginning of October is that the yuan is going into the SDR system.
Yeah.
And we've watched an incredible amount of the fear porn guys try and make it up into the world's next crisis, which I don't think it is, but it clearly is a signal of where we're going in the long run.
Right. Right. I don't think it's a crisis either, at least not to the sense that the fear porn guys are trying to make it. If anything, and I hate, you know, I'm no fan of the current Chinese government or system, but if anything, I think it's going to inject an element of stability into
yes.
the system more than anything
right.
else, because again, the source of the instability that we've been dealing with, you know, since the first Bush administration, George Herbert Walker Bush, is is this group of people that have basically used their wealth and power and influence within these various institutions, the central banks, the IMF, and so on, they have been the source of instability in the world. And I think the Chinese participation is going to inject balance back into the system, and it's going to inject some stability. Now, the problem here is I think you're probably well aware that the problem in China is not necessarily government debt, but corporate debt, which has ballooned and,
right.
and mushroomed enormously. So, you know, that's one thing to watch very, very definitely as to how the Chinese government's going to handle that. But I really think the days of Mr. Global getting everything his way and being able to run around and overthrow governments and, you know, arrive on jets and say that, oh, we came, we saw, and he died, and cackle and laugh, those days are drawing to a close. Things just can't keep going on. So I'm looking for at least some stability from this Chinese participation in the SDRs.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that if you listen to the G20 meeting conversations,
yes,
the folks at the G20 are much more interested in creating growth,
yes,
than in controlling top down.
Right.
So and as the economy slows down globally, you know, the increased friction from the controls, you know, you have expenses going up from all the centralization rules and complexity, and it's just creating more friction. And somebody said to me the other day, you know, no growth except growing friction.
Yep.
And that friction is what is making the whole system unbearable for the people who are trying to create more growth. Now, one other thing before we leave the multipolar world, Trans-Pacific Partnership and the other trade agreements, the services agreement, the European agreement, what do you think is going to happen, Joseph?
I think for the moment they're dead. I really do. As far as the European agreements are concerned, France and Germany both have signaled the fact that they're dead. I don't think that attempting to fasten the blame on Brexit is going to wash, because I think that they were well on their way to being dead before Brexit happened. The Trans-Pacific Agreement, again, I think the problem here is, and I've been trying to raise it, I think people are waking up here to the fact that, especially in that agreement, what you have is a case of corporations trying to use copyright law to shut down free speech, and they were just handed
right.
a huge defeat in courts in India. So, you know, I think the revolt is spreading there as well. We have the Philippines now courting Russia and courting China. You know, this is a huge story, because of course the Philippines
right.
has been basically a puppet government, a satrapy in effect of the United States, and this is a huge thing. And I, you know, whatever they may try to do to President Duterte, that's not going to change the course for the Philippines. You know, he's expressing the outlook and opinions of you know, the Filipino deep state. So again, I think this is a huge thing. So for the moment, I think it's dead. I noticed in the presidential debate again that Trump pointed this out about Hillary. You know, are you for or against it? Well, I'm against it, you know, she says. But no, she's not. The record's very clear. So I think it's dead, and I think part of the problem there is they may be thinking getting her into office is going to revive it. I don't think so. I really don't. There's too many questions. It's clearly an agreement designed to benefit American corporations. I just can't see Indonesia or Malaysia or India, or even for that matter Australia or China, going along with it, you know, hook, line, and sinker. I just don't see it.
Well, Obama had indicated he wanted to pass it in a lame duck.
Yep.
So between the election and the inauguration, at which point it's on him and she doesn't have to implement it.
Right.
So I still think they're going to make a major push to do that. And
they might, yeah.
Yeah. Now, Congress has said they won't play, but, you know, we'll see how many arms get twisted.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So another thing, just to keep going through the summary, one of the things we wrote a lot about, we talked a lot about at the beginning of the year, was that I thought investment in space was going to continue to grow. You agreed, and boy, have we seen it. I thought we were ahead of the curve, and then if you look at what's unfolded this year, it's explosive.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Yeah.
It is expanding. It is expanding so fast in now that it's hard to keep up with. NASA is pushing ahead with an outer space test of the EM drive, which to me is a very, very interesting thing because, of course, just turn the clock back 4 or 5 years, and you had NASA and certain bodies of scientists saying, well, the EM drive is a hoax. And now all of a sudden they've decided, well, no, there's something going on here, and now we need to test it in outer space. You've got Musk saying that he wants to go to Mars and so on and so forth. The real problem now, Catherine, is that it's known now that extended human stay in outer space basically gives you osteoporosis.
Right.
It atrophies your muscles, it atrophies your bone structure, so they're having to figure out a way of how can we sustain a human deep presence in space. Well, the Russians already know the answer to that, and that is you create a strong electromagnetic field, that reproduces climate conditions on Earth so that you don't subject yourself to all of these health issues in outer space. So that to me is very interesting that you have these announcements coming out of Russia and then NASA saying, well, we're testing the EM drive. And there's also been stories of, suspending human beings in a sort of suspended animation in stasis effectively and, waking them up when they get to wherever they're going. So they're talking about all these things again, and it suggests to me that they've known these things for a long time, and they're just cluing us in that the technologies that they're bringing online publicly have been there, and this is what they're going to use to go out there.
So the Russians are embarrassing them into admitting that they haven't.
Oh yeah, this is precisely what I think is going on. Russia's playing a very, very interesting game. To me it's uncanny. They're chess players, and when they make a statement in the press through their state controlled media, what they're doing is I've seen this pattern over and over, and it's very interesting to watch. What they're doing is they're responding to deep themes and memes in Western society. It's uncanny to me how accurate they are in doing this. And now recently, President Putin has appointed a new advisor, Anton Vino, whose whole academic specialty is using predictive programming analysis models, let's just call it that. But there's a physics, what's incredibly interesting to me is that there's a physics component to this in his thinking. So the Russians, in other words, they have their hands on some sort of physics and analysis technology, and now they've booted that up to an advisor position directly to President Putin himself. So I'm expecting Russia to make these kinds of stories even more a part of a pattern. It's going to be very, very interesting to watch.
It's almost like we're converging on Asimov's The Foundation here.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Right.
That's exactly what I think the Russians are up to. And I think the West has had similar knowledge of these things for a very long time, but again, it's the Russians that are pushing it out into the open.
The interesting thing is, if you read Brzezinski's article, one of the things he indicates is that, our competitors have gotten closer on military technology, and all it's going to take is,
yes,
a few accomplishments in the advanced technology realm to kind of flip the whole global model. And he describes it very peacefully and calmly, but if you look at what he's really saying, is he's saying if the Chinese and the Russians get a leg up on advanced, powerful technology, the whole model can flip. It's like what you and I were talking about in the second quarter wrap-up. If the Chinese get dominance in the South China Sea, it could flip the whole currency model.
Yes, and I think Brzezinski is pointing out something else very important here, although he may not have had the intention of doing so, and you and I have discussed this again. And that is, what are we getting for our money? Well, we're getting the F-35 fighter, which has so far been a $1 trillion boondoggle, and it still doesn't work. The USS Gerald Ford, the United States Navy's, you know, multi-billion dollar aircraft carrier, has electrical systems that doesn't work. The F-22 Raptor doesn't work as advertised. So we're spending a lot of money for stuff that's really not working too well, and the Russians have just demonstrated in Syria and the Donald Cook incident jamming capabilities that they have that can knock our systems out at a fraction of the cost to them. So in other words, they have, you know, the Russians in particular have invested their money very wisely in modernizing their military. And what I'm suggesting is all that money that has been awash in the black budget and in the hidden system of finance is no longer returning the cost to investment on investment that you need. It's not a wise return on investment anymore. And
right.
It's not boding well for the U.S. military. And I think this is one reason you see kind of the pause, the attempt at backtracking a bit in the Middle East and elsewhere, is they realize that, you know, we might be picking a fight with the wrong people here. So I think, yeah, I think Brzezinski, the subtext here is he's pointing out that even that part of the system is not giving us the return on investment that we need.
You know, it's funny. One of the themes that came up for me much more in the third quarter than in the second quarter, but it's been growing steadily, is this question of, you know, are our minds our own? And how much are we being influenced by the entrainment, the propaganda,
right,
you know, whatever the hidden technologies or, you know, techniques are? And I get more and more concerned about it, because when I talk with individual subscribers about the struggles they're having with their family and friends in all sorts of issues, including managing time and money.
Right.
What you're hearing is more and more stories about people getting tricked in doing things which are counter to their self-interest and their own, you know, I mean, they're behaving against their own self-interest again and again and again. It's happening a lot more. And I'm seeing it a lot more, you know, not to mention I've been out in the Bay Area and I'm seeing people who are being very aggressive in ways which are wholly suicidal, and it doesn't make any sense. You know, it's not rational. Anyway, so I was very pleased to see this new website, biggerthansnowden.com, where you had Nick Begich and Dr. John Hall and all sorts of whistleblowers on these hidden technology topics get together and come out with one website that just really pulls it all together. And when you look at the credibility and the quality of the people and all their work on this subject, you realize, whoa.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
The mind control technologies here, the mind manipulation, the entrainment, everything, I think is such a huge unexplored area. And the problem here economically and financially is this is yet another way of rigging markets, ultimately.
Right. Right.
Because what you're doing is you're influencing people's decision-making, their purchasing decisions, so on and so forth. And again, it's not giving a realistic picture of what the market really is. So in other words, the technology in a macroeconomic sense is suicidal.
Right.
Because it's not giving your own analysts any ability really to understand where the market's going. And what's amazing to me in addition to this, Catherine, is I don't know about you, but I'm not seeing the evidence that these technologies are in widespread usage outside of the West. In other words, even the communist Chinese government, I don't think, is resorting to these technologies with its own population to the extent that it seems to be the case here in this country. And the same thing in Russia. I'm not, you know, I have members on my website that live in Russia.
Right.
And you know, some of them are expat Americans. They've moved to Russia, of all places. and they're telling me that, you know, things are very different over there. People are much more expressive, much more intelligent, much more individuals than they are over here.
Well, when I was in Germany this summer, I was in Germany and Switzerland and Austria.
Mm-hmm.
It was just so much more human, Joseph. It was incredible.
Yes, I can believe it. Yeah, I can believe it.
Yeah.
It is. And you know, ultimately, this push of Mr. Global to centralize everything and control even people's thoughts, again, that's self-defeating. Because you're killing your own macroeconomic picture here.
Right, you're killing all the life force.
Right.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. You're killing
your
creativity.
You and I have talked a lot about productivity because we have, you know, one of the most infuriating things that happened in the third quarter was Alan Greenspan getting up and complaining that productivity growth was slowing, which meant we couldn't pay our retirement obligations. I was like, wait a minute, Alan, you just stole $52 trillion, and you're telling me productivity growth is the problem? Excuse me?
Yeah, exactly.
But so you and I just did a recording on productivity, and it was the theme of the second quarter wrap-up. So I'm not gonna repeat all of that, but I really strongly encourage people to read that because the balanced budget amendment is about to slam into the destruction of productivity that's being used to centralize the control of the economy. A couple of examples we had in the third quarter was the Department of Justice announced that they were not going to renew Bureau of Prison contracts with private prison companies. The next morning, their stocks were down almost 50%, which is a reminder that you really don't want to own companies whose finances are dependent on highly unproductive stuff, because at some point when the debt growth model is over, you know, they're going to have to cut something, and, you know, low productivity somethings are first things to cut. Another was the committee of faculty and students at Vanderbilt, who announced new sets of pronouns for trans or for sexually fluid people.
Oh boy, yes. I'm so glad that you included that, because I want to go directly to this. I want to clue people into something that they need to know. Anytime you hear language being tinkered with as a political agenda, what you're dealing with is you're dealing with a system of Gnosticism. And if you go back and look at the early Gnostic systems, you know, when I was a professor teaching theology in a seminary, I did not teach Gnosticism as a set of systems. I taught Gnosticism as a set of techniques by which you engineer the hollowing out and overthrow of institutions designed to protect and preserve culture, okay?
Wow.
And one of the key things in any Gnostic system is to tinker with language. And what this does, in effect, is you signal your subservience to the agenda, to your, you know, you signal your raised consciousness by adopting the language that they're proposing. And it's always, in a certain sense, it's always a very artificial language. And this is designed, in turn, to break down common discourse, and that in turn breaks down civilization and culture. You're creating a man-made Tower of Babel, so to speak, to break down the culture itself and break down, therefore, the discourse. And ultimately what this does, Catherine, is it results in the loss of productivity.
Right.
So, you know, if you think that it's all fun and trendy to be transgendered and to use this type of language and so on, I'm more concerned about the language than I am if people are transgendered. You know, I could care less if they're one thing or another. But the language itself is a very different matter, because this is what we use to communicate. This is what we use to cement our contracts. This is what we use to negotiate. This is what we use to create. When you break down the language, you are interfering at a very, very fundamental level. So, you know, I wholeheartedly urge people to, especially at Vanderbilt, just stand up and say no. I even recall and did a blog on my website, Catherine, about the fact that when I started my PhD, I originally had a scholarship at a major, I was offered a full scholarship at a major American university. The whole thing paid. But in order to do this, I was told that I would have to take a class. Now imagine this, a grown man taking a class in the use of gender-inclusive language. And I just said, no way. I told them no. And that's one of the major reasons I went to Oxford, because I wanted to go to a place where I had the freedom to argue what I wanted to argue and argue it in the diction and language that I chose, which is the standard diction and language of ordinary English. So,
good decision.
This is something that people have to be aware of. These are not harmless little fluffy feel-good things. We need to remember that the Bolsheviks did this inside of Russia with the Russian language after they took over, and the result was precisely what they calculated. It introduced a period of cultural shock and change that they were then able to manipulate and control. This was part of their revolution. So people
right.
need to be very, very cautious of these things.
Well, we just saw the announcement that the Navy is requiring all personnel to go through transgender training by the end of 2017.
Yes.
Do you know what an investment that is in terms of
exactly.
time?
Exactly. In terms of
the
time,
reality
yes.
is what the Navy needs to do is make sure that it can out with the Donald Cook situation.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, to me this is militarily suicidal. You don't use the military for social engineering. And you know, the sad fact is that, you know, since before World War II, even really before World War I, the U.S. military has been used by progressives in this country as a social engineering bed, a test
right.
bed. And, you know, I'm just very blunt about this. I don't care if people are transgendered or whatever, but the military is not the field on which you want to play with social engineering agendas, especially if you're Mr. Global and planning to confront Russia, you know, or perhaps even fight a war with Russia. I can guarantee you that people in the Russian Army or Navy or Air Force do not get sensitivity training. They get training in tactics, operations, you know, military stuff. You know?
Right.
And
well,
and we just saw the results of American operational training in the U.S. Army in Germany. We didn't even place.
Right.
You know,
right.
We came
that's
behind Denmark and Poland. No, that's
right.
not good.
That's not good. Another place where productivity has come out is we have watched enormous technology from the black budget and black budget money pour into Silicon Valley,
yeah.
lower their cost of capital. It's, you know, it's funny because the folks in Silicon Valley don't realize any of this, but it's arguably the most subsidized, you know, industry in the history of the world. And
yeah.
yet, if you look at what they're producing things that do not, you know, do not increase productivity growth. In fact, it's detrimental to productivity because they're doing things that improve surveillance capitalism, that improve central control, but they have contributed mightily to both shadow work and negative return on investment, you know, the destruction of privacy, on and on and on. I could go on forever. And I'm beginning to see just a hint and a whiff of people getting frustrated. You saw the one big article from the editor of, I think it was the editor of MIT Technology, write an article, "Dear Silicon Valley, forget flying cars, give us U.S. economic growth." And so people
yes.
are starting to realize, you know, all this really clever stuff, you know, it's not contributing. It's a drain.
It's not contributing and it's a drain. And, you know, I'll tell you, the automated cars business, which haven't been working out too well, people end up dead because they've been driving down the highway and the automated car, you know, doesn't know what a guardrail is, you know, things like this. But this whole business of the flying cars and the automated cars, as far as I look at that, Catherine, this is just another way to control the population. You know,
right,
they want everybody
exactly.
driving their, you know, automated cars, so that they can control population movement. You know, good luck with that, because I don't have $250,000 to spend on an automated car. You know? But yeah, you're exactly
right. Well, having
been
run off the road, so, or having people try and run me off the road several times during the litigation, do you think I'm ever going to get into a driverless car?
No, no, precisely. You know, do I trust these people? No, not as far as I can throw them. Thanks, thanks very much. So, yeah, they're exactly right. They need to start giving us something that contributes to human productivity and not to the surveillance state. Because, again, the surveillance state is killing the economy.
Right.
In so many ways.
I couldn't agree more.
Well, last but not least, I do want to touch on, to me, one of the exciting things that happened in the last quarter was your book on Common Core came out.
Mm-hmm.
And, I was quite eager to have it come out because I was very proud I wrote the foreword, so I wanted to publish it. But
and thank you for that, by the way.
If you ever doubt,
how dreadful Common Core is, here's your proof.
Well,
Josie
yeah,
did a great job of tearing it apart. It was kind of like watching a pit bull get a hold of a sirloin steak.
Well, in this case, I don't. It's more like rotten meat, but and the pit bull is starving. but yeah, the Common Core thing is just as far as I'm concerned, and my co-author is concerned. It was really my co-author that, even though I wrote about 50% of the book. The scaffolding on it, the order of argument and the principal concepts are coming from my co-author because he was the one that pointed out to me that Common Core was just nothing through the assessment process, was nothing but a vast expansion of the surveillance state.
Right.
And as I dug into this, I thought, it's a nightmare on steroids. Because it's designed to track you from kindergarten up through high school. And now we hear talks about, a lifetime learning accounts is the latest, you just have to laugh.
Lifetime learning about you.
Yeah, well, yes, exactly. This is exactly, right. They come up with all of these flowery euphemisms, and they're just not playing anymore because everybody sees through them. What that really means is they want to keep you in school all of your life and be able to update the assessment process. And as far as I'm concerned, Catherine, the whole Common Core, individually adaptive, standardized, computerized test is nothing more than a loyalty test. Are you loyal to the standard official narratives? In other words, imagine your SAT question, who killed President John Kennedy, Jack Ruby, Lee Harvey Oswald, but they're never going, those kinds of tests never allow you to get into real deep analysis and discussion of an event. In other words, they're designed to reinforce an official narrative and control the information.
At your heart, you're an Oxford scholar, so your approach is much nicer. I basically look at Common Core, and what it says to me is, are you available for pedophilia, and where can I access your calendar to book you?
Yes, exactly. Well, yeah, that puts it in a nutshell, because what they're doing, Catherine, is they're tracking you, and they're building up a profile
right.
of people. And, and the other bottom line here is that Common Core, the assessment process itself, the test, the questions remain proprietary information. So any information given to the government by these corporations is basically what they want you to have. And it completely guts education because I don't care what all of these technocrats say. And now there's studies coming out indicating that all of this technology in the classroom is producing a generation of technology addicts with very real problems with socialization, with being able to carry on a conversation. It's producing a generation of narcissists and psychopaths that are basically stupid. And this is the bottom line for me. It's stupidity that they're reinforcing, not education.
There's a wonderful new article in the Wall Street Journal, which I posted up in Top Picks this last week, and it'll be on the list for the third quarter news trends and stories. Two very successful physicians, from one's from Mass General, the other from Cambridge Hospital, basically saying that patient healthcare records have destroyed patient health and
the relationship
between the doctor, and which I believe is absolutely true.
And
absolutely.
You know, but you're seeing quite a pushback here. Okay, so one of the stories I wanted to bring up in the economy, it's both economy and financial markets as well as geopolitics, was to mention a little bit about Wells Fargo, because I've been absolutely fascinated. We just got through bailing out a huge housing bubble. We have a new housing bubble underway, some parties claim. We have Wells Fargo saying they created 1.5 million phony accounts and 500,000 phony credit card authorizations. But there's nobody on the Senate floor saying, well, wait a minute, did you create mortgages and auto loans for those same phony accounts?
Yeah, exactly.
Because we know the money is not in creating an account, right?
Right, right.
The money is in the loans. That's where all the fraud has occurred. And we have lots of stories about fraud at all the big banks, including Wells Fargo. So nobody's asking that question except for me. I did a commentary called Unanswered Questions about Wells Fargo, and I pointed out that the Fed now has, because of quantitative easing, they have purchased $1.7 trillion of mortgage-backed securities.
Good.
And what I want to know is that $1.7 trillion of phony mortgages.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and if it, you know, Catherine, if it is, they're running the same old pump-and-dump scheme that they ran prior to the bailouts.
Right. I don't think they ever stopped.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with you. I don't think they ever stopped either, and that's the problem, is they're running these pump-and-dump schemes and trying to prop things up, and you know, you can only continue with a fiction like this for so long, and the longer you continue it, the more the danger increases, because when the bubble is eventually burst, the damage is all the greater. So it needs to be addressed, and it needs to be addressed now. And again, I go back to what the Russians said recently. I think it was within the last couple of weeks, that these big banks and all of the fraud that they've perpetrated need to be brought out into light, and the people that have done these things need to go to jail. So I do think that there's going to be some in other words, what I'm suggesting is if Congress is not going to address this, I suspect that you're going to see various countries around the world increasingly band together to demand explanations from some of these big banks. And, you know, they may be able to boondoggle the U.S. Congress through their control files, but I don't think they're going to have much success with the Kremlin or with Beijing. So this is something I genuinely want to warn people about. It's my suspicion you're going to see some international pressure now beginning to build on these banks.
Right.
And again, you know, the problem here, Catherine, geopolitically, is it's going to show the U.S. government up for being the corrupt front for these interests that it is. So it's,
well, here's
you
the
know,
interesting thing, because we're trying to keep the Germans from getting together with the Russians.
Yeah.
The Russians ban the GMOs, and you know, and that the Duma ban was a big event in the third quarter. At the same time, we're squeezing the Germans on Deutsche Bank and Volkswagen, and suddenly a German company comes in and at a 44% premium takes everybody out of Monsanto.
Yep.
And you wonder, did the Russians force us to do that? Because the GMO thing is seriously, seriously stalled.
It's seriously stalled, and you know, even in Europe, there's opposition within Germany, within France, within Hungary, those three countries particularly, against GMOs. So I'm wondering, like you, I'm wondering just exactly why Bayer decided to do this. And I'm also mystified at the fact that Bayer had that much cash on hand that it could even do that. So, you know, I'm wondering exactly the same thing. What's going on here, you know? So it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. I think that if you look at the United States and Germany right now, it appears that there's some sort of, to me anyway, there's some sort of tug of war going on between these two countries. regarding
right.
Germany and the course that it wants to take. I don't expect Merkel's government to last much longer, quite frankly. I mean, even she's
She's been delivered quite a blow in the recent elections. Maybe we should talk a little bit about that.
Well, yeah, the CDU, the Christian Democratic Union, which is her political party, the other big one in Germany is the Social Democrats. But Merkel, it's important for people to remember that Merkel was a protege of the former Chancellor Helmut Kohl, and of course this means that she, like Kohl, has huge connections and backing from the big German chemicals firms, Bayer, BASF, and so on. Basically, just think of IG Farben.
Exactly.
When you think of Angela Merkel. But she has been, you know, the linchpin of the European refugee policy. And, of course, it's hugely unpopular in Europe. It's hugely unpopular in the Netherlands, in France, in Sweden, in Germany. And what this has done is it's provoked a backlash and the formation of political parties that appear to be wanting to defend their borders and their culture. And I put it in those terms, Catherine, because there's two elements within these political parties. One element, I think, which represents the majority, is just, you know, pissed off Germans that are looking at all the rapes and so on happening in their country, and the fact that the refugees are being given special privileges and advertisements are being run on German TV for German women to adopt the Habib and make everybody feel welcome and multicultural. Well, you know,
who is running that?
Yeah, I have no idea. I think it's the German government, actually. But there's been the inevitable reaction from Germans, you know, the birthplace of the Reformation and so on and so forth, you know, that this is just not going to happen. So they're pushing back against this. And they delivered Angela Merkel in Berlin itself a huge local election defeat when these parties basically won the election. They delivered her a sound drubbing. The danger, of course, is within these parties you're going to have the fringe fascist element. This is what worries me. But this movement in Europe against the refugees and to defend European and national culture, you know, we see it in France with Marine Le Pen. We see it in the Netherlands with Geert Wilders. This isn't going to go away until she goes away and the policy is changed. Now, she's backpedaling as a result of this election defeat that maybe her policy really wasn't all that good. But I, you know, this is too late, too little too late, Angela. I think her government is in danger. I don't think the CDU will be returned to power, even in a coalition government. So what I'm looking to see happen in the next major German national elections is I suspect you're going to see the SDP take power in a coalition government, and the SDP I think is going to try and tighten these refugee policies and make it much more difficult. But you know, that's my best guess. A lot of this, the other problem here, Catherine, is that Germans are waking up to the fact that a lot of that policy was being driven not so much in Berlin, but in Washington, and more importantly, in Silicon Valley.
Right.
We have
right.
indications now, uncontestable indications, that Soros was behind a lot of this. So again, there's your fascist connection. I really don't expect Merkel's government to. If she does, let's put it this way: if she does manage somehow to stay in power, her government is going to be very, very weak, and she's going to be much less the commander in chief of the European Union that she's been. And I really expect the same thing in France. There are big rumblings in France. Hollande's government is in trouble. Precisely for the same reasons, they're now trying to front a candidate to take the wind out of Marine Le Pen's sails. I don't think it's going to work. This is what my website members in France are telling me. So, you know, those two countries are fed up. And ultimately, Catherine, what this means is they're fed up with Washington. That, to me, is the hugest news.
Here's what I think they're fed up with, Joseph. I think they're fed up with things that destroy productivity and wealth.
Exactly. And you can't blame them.
Right.
And again, this is coming out of Mr. Global, but for the European mind, that means Washington, and to a certain extent, they're correct. So, you know, we're looking at the long range dissolution, I think, of NATO. I pointed this out, I think, in our last talk, that
right.
Rheinmetall and Nestor merged. This huge German and the huge French armaments firm have merged. And the reason they've done this, in my opinion, is because they want to standardize military equipment. They want to create their trans-European military under, you know, under Franco-German leadership, essentially. And what that means is the end of NATO. This is the way for Europe to sidestep and bypass NATO and therefore bypass Washington and Mr. Global.
So one other thing, let's come back around to the election, because we're going to, mm-hmm. we're discussing this and we're going to publish these in the first 2 weeks of October, and the election mm-hmm. is November 7th. I just saw a new survey of global investors, and mm-hmm. It's a poll of their top 10 to 20 risk issues and risks that concern them. And what has risen to their number one risk is the U.S. election, because mm-hmm. I think they see, you know, one of the candidates, it's what Peggy Noonan said, we have a choice between a criminal and a crazy person. But, you know, the criminal, they understand their policies, you know, that's a syndicate they know and understand, and they understand what it means.
Right.
Whereas the other candidate, they're not clear what it means.
Right.
And they know that the first candidate, if need be, will have a World War III with Russia to protect the syndicate interests.
Right.
Not to say that that's good for investors, but, you know, I don't think they're completely aware of how bizarre the syndicate's willing to get. But either way, I think their concern is that they're coming into unpredictable change, and that they don't understand. And it may just be grief that they're starting to realize, you know, that this party is over. And and we're not going to keep centralizing, even if it means destroying, you know, the living systems and the real wealth on the planet. So investors are clearly, that's the one thing I can say, you know, other than Monica Lewinsky, too.
Mm-hmm.
We do have a choice between the criminal syndicate and change. And
right.
And investors are concerned about it. I would argue that they should be concerned about the real fundamentals. But, you know, maybe they are. Who knows? But here's my question to you. What do you think is going to happen?
In the election? I honestly don't know. You know, I still think that if, as it seems right now, I just looked at polls of the debate and who people think won the debate, and overwhelmingly, which shocks me, overwhelmingly, people think Trump won it, and sometimes by very wide margins.
Well, here's the interesting thing. Last night I went to look at, there was one website that ranked up 20 polls,
mm-hmm.
and I went through all of them, and Trump had won, you know, by anywhere by little to a huge margin, even in websites that I would consider Democrat.
Yes.
And then today, when I looked at CNN and sort of the major press, it was like, oh, Clinton really won. And it was just, well, wait a minute, that's not what any of
the polls last night
showed. Yeah, so it was very strange.
They're living in a world of make-believe, the mainstream media. I don't see or sense all that much support for Hillary other than from, you know, from the oligarchs that view Trump as such a wild card that they don't know what happened. But I don't think that that means that they're enthusiastic for Hillary.
Right.
But I go back, you know, if to me, Catherine, I think there's a real danger that if they sense a Trump victory, that they might pull some sort of fast one. And I've heard so many scenarios about what sort of fast one they would attempt to pull that it would be impossible to catalog them all here. But I you know, for me, the real problem is geopolitics and the international markets. And if Hillary gets in, the Russians have already signaled that if she gets in, you know, as far as Russia's concerned, they have to hunker down and brace themselves for a war.
Right.
And, you know, that's a very real possibility. And I can tell you, Catherine, that if that happens, I do not think the United States would win it if, you know, if we manage to avoid going nuclear. Because I don't see Europe going along with it. I just do not see the support for any of that in Germany. You know, if we did this, we'd have to have the support of the big two European powers. And I don't see the support in Germany. I don't see the support in France. I think we would be isolating ourselves much more than we are now if they went that route. And you know, incidentally, we can kiss goodbye to Japan as well.
Right.
So I really don't see that. And, you know, we're trying to stabilize the Pacific and we go to war with Russia. I don't think that you're going to find Australia or New Zealand or the Philippines or Indonesia leaping onto that bandwagon. I just don't see it. So, you know, I don't put it past the insane people in the neocon faction of the American deep state from doing something like that. But if they think they're going to coerce all of our allies into going along with it, I think they've got another thing coming. Britain won't do it. So the other alternative is Trump. I think now that there's a good possibility that he might actually win the election. If that happens, geopolitically, I think you're looking at a much more stable world. I really do. I don't think that he's interested in confrontations with Russia, because really, you know, he's a cost-benefit analysis sort of person, and he's not going to see any benefit for the cost of a war with Russia in any, you know, bottom line or otherwise. So I think if there's a Trump victory, you're going to see a change, as he's indicated himself. You're going to see a change in Russo-American relations, and he's going to get very serious about dealing with the problem of Islamic terrorism in a way that the neocons don't want. I think Trump is cagey enough to realize that our alliance system is in tatters, and that the, you know, that relationship has to be repaired. So it's anybody's guess here, Catherine. Of the two, let me put it this way. I think Peggy Noonan is right. We have a choice between a criminal and somebody we just don't know what's going to happen. But between the two, I view Hillary as the much more dangerous candidate. She's an inveterate liar. She's a criminal. She has no real sense of the fine balance of things. She's just in it to continue the racketeering operation she's been running. So I view her and that whole crowd as the much more dangerous candidate, not just for foreign policy, but for domestic politics, because we'll have the past 15 to 16 years on steroids with her, and the infrastructure in this country is going to continue to decline and crumble. Trust in the economic system is going to I think just hit absolute bottom. Productivity, you know, who wants to produce under a system like that?
So let me just ask you. We have the CDC coming out with a new rulemaking that
they're inviting
comments. The comments close on October 18th. So it looks like they want to get it out by certainly by the inauguration.
That will allow
the CDC, if they say they're concerned that you might have been exposed to a virus they're concerned about, they can round you up, and put you in camps, and, you know, put stuff in your arm. I mean, proceed to inject, you know, God knows what into your body. So you know, you're basically talking about Auschwitz here.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
So,
and again, I don't put it past these people. I don't.
So, I just think that's a very sobering piece of information.
It is because it indicates just what the United States has become. It is a de jure, if people haven't woken up to realize it, it's a police state, and it is the political left, and by that I mean both the Democrats and the Republicans. We've got basically a one party system in this country. We've got a party of the hard left and then a party of the soft left. We don't have any really genuine party of the right or conservative. And this is, I think, also what scares them about Trump. is because to a certain extent he has remade that whole kind of Robert Taft wing of the Republican Party. And this, you know, they don't have a control over it, and that's what scares them. They're facing an opposition party for the first time in a very, very long time. And moreover, a party that has much more direct popular appeal than anything I've seen in support for Hillary. So it's really not just a referendum on nationalism versus globalism. It's also a referendum on the elites
sovereignty
versus the people. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, so that's it for economy and financial markets as well as geopolitics. Before we close part one, Joseph, any thoughts of summary? The third quarter, what, you know, if you were going to summarize what the third quarter meant to you, what would you say?
Well, I can boil it down to one word, and that's uncertainty.
Right.
Looking at what's going on in this country, particularly with the election, I try to imagine myself, if I were a person with lots of money to invest, what would I be doing right now? And I have to honestly say, I don't know what I'd be doing. I think I'd be hedging my bets as much as I could. I'd have my bailout bag and my bailout airplane ticket and everything ready to go. But you can't have an economy functioning in that sort of doubt as to what's going to
right.
happen.
Right.
So I'm very uncertain. You know, and to put it bluntly, I'm uncertain, even though I don't have any sort of money to invest in anything. But I'm sort of uncertain even as to my own little business. What am I going to do in terms of a Hillary presidency? Because I know that she's going to come after the alternative media in this country in a major way and try and shut it down because it's been so opposed to her. So in other words, I'm looking at having to self-censor just to be able to maintain an income. And that's a restriction on free speech, and therefore that's a restriction on creativity.
Right.
And therefore that's a restriction on productivity, the human productivity that we talked about the last time. By the same token, if Trump gets in, I still don't know what to do because I don't know exactly how he is going to be able to influence this behemoth of an out-of-control government.
Well, Trump I can't tell you about, but I've been dealing with the Clintons for 18 years, so I'll give you a big briefing. maybe we should do a Soleri report on how to deal with the Clintons.
Well, listen, that would be good. Listen, that would be good because I don't think many of the foreign listeners, other than perhaps the British, have a real clue as just to how deep that rabbit hole of corruption really is, going all the way back to their Arkansas years. The whole business with Mina and Barry Seal and Terry Reid and the connection, the deep connection of the Bushes and the Clintons. Most people are unaware of that. So I think, you know, maybe a review would be good because I'm very serious because I get
questions.
Well,
I know, but sometimes on the roundup, you know, our team gets together for the roundup twice a week. I'll say, okay, on this story, are we willing to spend $2,000 on hacking costs to do this story? You know, are we willing to do $5,000? What's our price? You know, no, we have to price it. It's a practical.
Sure, yeah.
It's a practical issue, you know, and some stories are so good, I say, I don't care if it's going to cost $5,000, I'm going to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all part of the financial equation. Well, the one thing I would, there are two things I would do. You know, I'm left, I agree with you, uncertainty rising, risk rising. The two things I always do is I always pray because I believe if I'm where the big guy wants me, you know, I'll be fine. But the other thing is, I'm going to be in Tulsa on October 15th. And one thing I can tell you, without any uncertainty, you and I are going to have a blast.
Well, yeah, I agree. You know, whenever we get together with these groups, we always have these wonderful, you know, unscripted conversations that go. I'm serious. That go off in a thousand directions. And you know, those conversations are part of human productivity.
Right.
Because when you start listening to other people's take on things and you start to realize, oh, I hadn't thought of that, you know, and you start pooling the ideas together, you know, great things happen. So I look forward, you know, to every conference, to all of these get-togethers, you know, like we're having in Tulsa. I love those things because I love, you know, to listen to people's ideas and bounce things around.
Right. I particularly like it when I'm not the designated driver.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
Okay, so ladies and gentlemen, you can learn more on our websites, October 15th, Tulsa, dinner from 7 to 11. I think you're going to really enjoy it if you can come out. Anyway, so Joseph, that's it for part one. Thank you very much, and I look forward to part two the following week.
All right. Thanks for having me back, Catherine.